from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak, and joining me as guest co-host today is Carolyn Wara. She's executive director of Recycle Utah. Thanks, Carolyn, for agreeing to sit in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to some conversation today.
What are we going to talk about?
Yeah, on today's show, we first talked to Brian McErnie from the National Weather Service. Brian joined us at the start of each season to provide a recap on the past season's temperatures and precipitation. So we'll be looking at how northern Utah's winter unfolded this year.
That's right. We'll also talk about the state of Utah's reservoirs and watersheds. Much of Utah is currently experiencing moderate to extreme drought. So Brian will explain how that might impact our rivers and lakes going into this spring. Then in the second half of the show, I'll chat with Carolyn about Recycle Utah's search for a new home. It's a reality that's just a couple of years away. So where will they go? What might they look like? And why is Summit County's Solid Waste Master Plan critical to Recycle Utah's future?
And finally, a group of University of Utah students are converting thousands of plastic shopping bags into sleeping mats. They're crocheting the bags together. Student Caitlin McLean stops by the studio to explain and demonstrate the process.
That's right. Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our email address, thisgreenearth@kpcw.org, or you can text Carolyn's phone.
Yeah.
You can
if, you
if you
have my
questions.
Number, you have that special
yeah,
privilege.
Ask your
I'm
questions.
Not going to give it out on
exactly.
air.
Exactly. No, don't do that. Now, our connections with and impacts upon the environment and our natural resources, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Tell me one thing
more than this. Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Chris Wissner, store manager of Jan's, a longtime supporter of KPCW. Jan's guides fly fishing excursions to local waters and private ranches. Our fly shop is stocked with the gear you need, and our guides are ready to take you to the river. Serving Park City for over 30 years, Jan's Mountain Recreation Experts. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week, and joining me as guest co-host is Carolyn Wara, Executive Director of Recycle Utah. And our first guest, as always, he comes on every, let's say, solstice and equinox, plus or minus, to give us a recap on the past season. It's Brian McInerney. He's a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. And as always, Brian, thanks a lot for coming in this morning.
Sure. Yeah, it's always good.
All right. Well, we'll see how good it is.
Yeah.
With weather and climate-wise. Let's start, as we usually do, a recap of the past season. Winter is, you know, more or less over.
Yeah.
How did we do this winter? First of all, with respect to kind of temperatures, was it above average, below average, it swing around?
We started the water year 2018 with the hottest November we've ever seen. And that was evidenced by we actually had precip that was in the range of 120 to 150%. And you think starting off the ski year, we should be doing quite well. But unfortunately, it fell as rain all the way up to 10,000 feet on many of the really big storms.
Wow.
And that was unfortunate. And then we were warm in December, we were warm in January, and then February came, and we were kind of mild, and it was nice. And if you were a skate skier, the track came back. It was mud before that, and then we had that cool period, and it snowed down below 7,000 feet. And we actually started to replenish our low-elevation snowpack because it was non-existent up to that point. And it was a nice touch, but unfortunately it got warm again and we melted it off pretty quick. So it was kind of a little taste of
so overall,
low elevation snow.
The temperature this past winter has been kind of at least above average.
Yeah. If you look at the meteorological winter, December, January, February, we were about 5 to 7 degrees above average.
Wow.
Across the West for the most part.
But that is above.
Yeah. It's quite warm.
And
we're getting used to this, though. This is how it...
Yes.
How these things work lately. But yeah, for the meteorological winter, we were really quite warm all the way across the West.
All right. So then let's turn to precipitation. Again, you talked about at least in early parts of November, the beginning of the season, wet in terms of rain. What was the snowfall overall like for the winter?
Really quite grim. We were up until mid-February for Utah, we had many locations throughout the state that were recording record lows that we haven't seen since we've been keeping records, automated records, for the past 30 years. The last winter that we were comparing to was 76-77, and we were on track to have one of the worst winters ever, but the pattern shifted a bit in mid-February, and we had some zonal flows. If you remember, we didn't have many inversions. The air quality cleaned up down, and it's because we had just a gentle flow come through. Nothing big, but enough to kind of give us a little more storm activity. And then as of late, we had one atmospheric river event, which is a narrow band of moisture that comes across the west and just puts down copious amounts of snow and rain. And we're going to have another one of those coming up. So overall, our snowpack at Park City Mountain right now is about 70% of average. If you go farther south, the numbers get worse. It's about 57% down in the Provo drainage. And if you go north into the Bear up near Logan, they're about 90%. If you go farther down into the Virgin, things are really pretty grim at about 40% snowpack. And I think that's overdone a bit because where we measure snow is north-facing slopes in the trees, and the south-facing aspects are void of snow, even up here, up to about 11,000 feet, and there's really nothing below 7,000 feet at this time.
Wow. Okay. So again, overall, precipitation has been below average, although you're saying that in the short term, i.e. the next few days, we may see some storms come through?
It's this weekend. We expect an atmospheric river event that could put 2 inches of water. It's going to be almost all rain for the most part.
So it's a warm
event that comes across. They used to call this the Pineapple Connection, but now that they've termed this atmospheric river events, and they're really studying these things because they're getting more intense. And if you look last year, we had drought for 5 years. In December and January, we had numerous atmospheric river events, and we went from drought to worrying about floods in 2 months and wiped out the drought in just 2 months' time. We had 41 atmospheric river events last winter. This year we haven't had many just due to the high pressure, but overall, water supply runoff is going to be quite low this year. Peak flows will be quite low, and we're going to just see the snowpack kind of go away.
Can you explain this atmospheric river event a little bit further? Is this a new phenomenon, or is this something we've always had and we've just put a label on it? What exactly happens?
So what it is if you think of atmospheric circulation, it's a narrow band about 350 miles wide of incredibly supersaturated moisture. If you were to stand in there, it would be like you were in a pool. And this extends from Hawaii in a direct line right into the western U.S., and if you're in where the hose is, you're going to get a lot of moisture, 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 inches of precip, either in the form of snow if it's a little colder, but mostly rain. And it's dependent on how many of these things you have in the year. But California gets their water supply from these atmospheric river events. It's an intense system that moves into a narrow band. And as our atmosphere warms, we're getting more intense version of these, and that will continue to become more intense. And California at this point had so many wildfires that the debris flow threat is so great, they really worry about these atmospheric river events because they cause these mud flows and debris flows and all sorts.
Down in Montecito area.
Yeah, it killed all those people last year. So they're quite hazardous. They can turn a drought around really quick. But it's more of what we see on a regular basis is the precipitation events are becoming more extreme as we continue to warm the atmosphere. It's just the warmer air can hold more moisture. And as a result, when it does rain, especially for Utah, down in southern Utah, our thunderstorms are much more intense. We're seeing greater intensity over areas that really can't take these rainfalls, and we get flash floods that are pretty scary.
All right, so warmer, a warmer Utah, the trends are such that you say, you talk about on average, Utah is warming 3-4 this winter, 4 to 5 degrees warmer. And that's both daytime high. That's averaging both daytime highs, nighttime lows.
Yeah.
And nighttime lows, we've always talked about, are also as critical, if not more critical, because it affects the watershed too when you have warmer nights.
Yeah. It doesn't get as cold at nights the way it used to. As the heat from the day is trying to escape back into the atmosphere, we have more CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide that absorbs that heat and re-radiates it back in the atmosphere. And as a result, we have things like the beetle kill early in the late fall when it used to get to 20 degrees below zero and kill the bugs. Now we don't see that anymore, and the bugs are proliferating. Plus, we don't have the melt freeze that you have later in the spring. It's warmer, so snowpack starts to melt earlier as that continuous melt freeze cycle just goes to a melt cycle for 24 hours.
Right, and again, so our winters are kind of being nibbled away at the edges.
Yeah.
They're starting a little later, i.e., like, again, what happened this past November was more of a rain event. No, it was wet, but it was more rain, and perhaps they're ending sooner because of the warmer and warmer temperatures overall. And you're saying then, though, our precipitation events or the intensity of our storms is going to increase over time, stronger storms, putting down either rain or snow. It could be strong storms that are in the form of snow in the middle of winter. But the intensity of these storms is going to increase.
If you look at our storms coming out of the Pacific Northwest, they used to come on a regular basis, for us during the winter, and we would have good snow really on a regular basis. We had low variability in the frequency of the storms. Now what we're seeing are the storms are less frequent, but they're more intense when they get here. And these are the storms out of Alaska during the wintertime. We have longer periods of high pressure followed by an intense storm. Because overall, we haven't had less precipitation in the Wasatch. It's just that the form of the precipitation is evolving from total snow to a little bit more rain. And eventually, we'll be in a rain-driven hydrology by about 2080, 2090. We won't have snow here anymore.
2080 or 2090, 60 years from now.
Yeah. It's
not
very far.
How about the Olympics? we're thinking of hosting the Olympics in 2030.
Yeah. Well,
what do you think? I don't want to put you on the,
no, it's
on
okay.
the front, but I
mean, actually talked to the Olympic Committee about this.
Okay. What's the word?
I think the biggest problem the Olympic Committee is going to have to deal with are snow levels down at the low elevations for the cross-country events,
right.
the Nordic events, because the Europeans can't train at high elevations. So these events have to stay low at about 5,000 feet, 6,000 feet in that range. And we're going to see problems with snow at that elevation. The snow line is climbing up by 2030. It could be a good year, if we get the pattern shifts, but we're playing with loaded dice, meaning the probability of a low year where they won't have snow in those venues becomes greater. As far as the events on the hill, they should be okay. We have snowmaking to compensate, and they should be able to make snow by 2030. It should be still cold enough at the higher elevations that they can make snow for the alpine events. But the Nordic events could be problematic for them.
So Soldier Hollow.
Yeah.
It would be problematic to host cross-country events in Soldier Hollow.
Yeah.
Which is what? Below 7,000 feet.
Yeah.
So you're saying we'd have to have our cross-country events, et cetera, find a home for them at 7,000 or 8,000 feet.
Well, you can't do that because the Europeans. This is what I understand.
They need to
compete at lower levels.
They compete at much lower levels.
Yeah.
So okay.
I mean, Soldier Hollow has snowmaking, but if they don't have temps low enough to make snow, we can't.
It doesn't matter.
I mean, it's higher up in the mountain, you can make snow. But,
and you could have a year that's cold and anomaly, more noise in the data. But again, you might have a year that's quite hot compared to what we're anticipating by then.
Hold on. We're speaking with Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service, talking about this past season's temperatures and precipitation. I want to continue this conversation about hosting the Olympics in 2030. Look, you've been coming on this show for 6, 7, 8 years. And, 10 or 15 years ago, the start of this century, you recognized, you in the business of meteorology, climatology, recognized that we're going through a warmer we're going to get a warmer and warmer world. Well, we're 18 years in. What are the trends? Are the trends unfolding as we saw them, perhaps unfolding, predicted that they would in 2001, 2002?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
If anything, they're going faster and bigger than what the climatologists that did the research this. They've been looking at this since 1980s, 1970s.
Okay. Right.
And they found this trend. And if anything, what you find is our things are unfolding faster than what the climatologists talk about. And the people that do the work in this field, they're very conservative. They tend to underdo what the research may show, for good reason, because these are the voices of truth. This is what you want to do. You don't want to be an alarmist. You want to give the data and explain your results exactly how it shows and explain the uncertainty. But with that comes a little bit of conservatism that they don't want to go too far. But what you find is temperatures, precipitation events, beetle kill, forests, all these things that I've learned about throughout the years are unfolding faster than what they talked about when they first started doing the research.
So unfolding in terms of temperature, rates of temperature climb.
Yeah.
These changes in precipitation events and intensity of them, they all kind of anticipated this is what was going to happen. But you're saying they act with precaution, a measure of precaution. It's like, well, it could be 5 or 6 degrees warmer. But you know what? The range is somewhere between 3 and 8. So we'll say 4 degrees warmer. So you're like, they always kind of come down a little bit off the what might be the actual average. But you're saying that they're underestimating it in a sense because of their precautionary.
And I think they're showing what they actually found. But then when you see what's happening, things were a little bit faster. So then they go back and see why things are occurring faster. And with any research, there's amount of error. Any forecast we make at the National Weather Service, there's error in every forecast because you can't quantify the entire atmosphere. So you quantify the error and then throw it out there. And the results that they showed were really quite high as far as confidence intervals go. And now the question really is, they put the question of, is it getting hotter and are we causing it? That was about 5 to 10 years ago. They answered that question,
That's done.
Now it's what's going to happen with the precipitation patterns. That's what they're working on now. And a lot of the work that I've seen now is trying to figure out how to forecast farther than we can for long range. Can we forecast out 6 months to a year? You know, the Weather Service, we forecast 7 days out, and we talk about what's going to happen in that 7 days and what may occur that may damage society. But there are scientists trying to get 6 months out based on sea surface temperatures by all these different teleconnections, because it's really important, and California is a really good example of this. When they had drought, they were putting wiffle balls in the reservoirs to stop evaporation in October and November. The atmospheric river events happened last year, December, January. Mid-February, they almost lost Oroville Dam because the spillway was becoming eroded. They had to release so much water. That was two and a half months' time that they had. If they could give them a longer time frame to say this is going to happen, they can plan for it. They can plant different crops. They can have better things. So a lot of the work that I see is the scientists trying to come up with a way to forecast longer, a better forecast. We do it now, but it's very poor. Skill is very poor beyond 7 days. But if they could do, say, 2 weeks, a month, 6 months, that would be very helpful.
I liked your simple explanation. Right now, you can't predict what a drop of water will do beyond, 3 or 4 days?
7 days.
7 days?
Yeah.
It's just like, that's what you're looking at. The granularity of it is like, what will this drop of water do? Where will it go? Where will it be?
Yeah.
What form will it be in? And that's the challenge, writ large.
Yeah.
That's the modeling
and
challenge.
And it's 7 days. It precipitates out some way. So you have a whole new data set you're looking at. That's why it falls apart after 7 days.
Okay.
So has this long-term forecasting become an option because technology is better, scientists have learned more, or is weather becoming more predictable that it's easier to predict what's happening?
If anything, the technology has gotten much better. Computing power has gotten much, much better. But the atmosphere is a different atmosphere than they used to forecast before. So you can't look at the past atmosphere and say, what's it going to do in the future? Because it's a different atmosphere now. We were at 250 parts per million right around the Industrial Revolution. for CO2 levels. Now we're at 408 parts per million. It's the most CO2 we've had going back 800,000 years by far. It used to be in a range of about 320 to 180 parts per million for CO2. Now we're at 408. So the atmosphere is supercharged. It can handle more heat. It can handle more moisture. So trying to model that is really difficult. And for the people that just have done it in the same way all the time, the forecasts are finding they're not very good at all beyond 7 days. So that's why there's a new group of scientists that are kind of stepping back and saying, let's start over and let's see what else is out there that we can look at. Mm-hmm. What teleconnections, what sea surface temperatures, any correlations, any way we can do this. And then using that superior technology, they have made progress on this, which is really kind of cool.
And let's remember, CO2 is not the only greenhouse gas. Methane, nitrous oxide, different forms of chlorofluorocarbons, they all play a role as greenhouse gases, and their concentrations have all increased dramatically, too.
Right.
So you have this whole soup of greenhouse gas.
And one thing we really don't talk about is water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but it's always been roughly about the same throughout hundreds of thousands of years. Now that we have more CO2 in the atmosphere, that has warmed our atmosphere. That warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor. So the CO2 is like a little nudge of a skateboarder on a hill. The water vapor then, as the skateboarder goes down the hill, picks up speed really quick. We have much more water vapor in our atmosphere. That's why we're seeing storms that are much more intense now.
All right, last few minutes. I want to circle back to precipitation and such. What's the state of the reservoirs and the watersheds here in Utah?
Oh, it's really good. We're about
That was not what I expected to hear, but that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a direct result of the carryover from last year.
From last year.
We were going into water year 2017, reservoirs were about 30% full throughout northern Utah. This year we're about 80 to 85% full, and that's a direct result of the amount of runoff that we had last spring, 150 to 200% runoff into those reservoirs, filled up those reservoirs, and then they had to do flood control to eliminate any damage downstream. And as a result, Bear Lake filled, all the reservoirs filled. Lake Powell went up a little bit compared to what it typically does. Lake Mead did better. And then you have this year, which is quite low, but we have really good reservoirs. All you have to do is drive past Deer Creek. It's full. Jordanelle is, I think, is about 80% full. Rockport, I think, is full. All these reservoirs are close to filling. Bear Lake probably won't fill this year, but it'll get close. And that's from carryover from last year.
Well, it's interesting, this couple of maps from NOAA that depict the seasonal drought conditions. Right now, like you say, this area, the whole southwest, west area of the U.S. is under moderate to extreme drought. And the outlook, though, is that those conditions will continue. So we may not be... The reservoirs are full, but we may not see a lot of additional inflow into those reservoirs.
Yeah. Think of it as money in the bank. Last year, you did really well. You put a lot of money in the bank. This year, you didn't do as well. So you're taking money out of the bank to go this year. You don't want to put these back to back to back like we did from 2012 to 2016. 5 years of below average runoff brought us to 30% reservoir. Unfortunately, when you look at why it didn't snow this year, the high pressure that's set up over the west, that dominant weather feature has been increasing since 1980, and we anticipate that to get bigger in the future as we warm. So we can expect more high pressure during the winters, which means less snow, and that means less reservoir contents, and we're going to start sliding into a drier climate. Continually, you know, we'll have noise in the data, which will be bigger years, but overall the trend is one of drier winters and warmer winters.
And warmer winters, drier, okay. Again, the nibbling at the edges plus drier overall, less precipitation. Not a great forecast.
No.
Going forward. Last thing, is it true that at some point this winter, the North Pole actually experienced temperatures above freezing?
Yeah, there was February 22nd, had temperatures 45 degrees above the average for that area. And that's a direct result of our jet stream that used to be a little wiggle going around. Now it's becoming much more sinuous. It's a big north-south jet stream. So it goes off the Pacific, it bounces into the high pressure on the west coast. then the jet stream goes up into the Arctic and it brings all that warm air, warms the Arctic, but then the cold air in the Arctic is then shunted down into the Midwest and then down into Alabama and Mississippi where they had snow.
Right.
Then the jet stream swoops back up and goes up the East Coast. So the people in the Midwest and the East are under a very stormy, cold regime, while the West is under a very dry, warm regime. And they call it a dipole weather system. And that dipole weather system is becoming more pronounced, more elongated. And as a result, the Arctic, and it's a direct result of the Arctic warming faster than the equator. So the jet stream is now trying to transport temperature, pressure, and moisture from the Arctic down into the equator, and that's why the jet stream is becoming much more elongated. It's like a big sine wave where it used to be little wiggles. So, each little wiggle was a storm.
Right.
Now the storms are few and far between as that jet stream becomes much more loopy, and we'll probably see more of that until eventually it gets so warm that this whole dipole weather model breaks down, and then we'll see after that. But that's not for some time. We can expect more high pressure during the winters as we move forward.
So bigger peaks, higher peaks, deeper troughs. And that's why it's almost counterintuitive, obviously, to think that well, it's cold. You're saying it gets really cold down in the southern part of the U.S. during the winter this year because of climate change?
Yeah.
And the answer is yeah. That's the consequences. Again, that climatologists, meteorologists were kind of seeing back in the 80s and 90s the consequence. And it's unfolding at a rate that is actually greater than some of their models, average models suggest.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. If you were just somebody in Alabama, or you're thinking it's freezing here, it's snowing.
Don't tell me this planet's warming when it's freezing.
Because they're used to warm, and now it's cold. But it's a direct result of the transport of the cold air from the polar regions down into more of the latitudes down in that area.
All right. As always, website.
Weather.gov?
Weather.gov.
You need a forecast in the next 7 days, look at weather.gov.
We got rain. Yeah, it's a rain event. Here are the highs in the low 50s Thursday and Friday. But again, that's at this elevation, maybe at 9, 10, 11,000 feet. It still might
probably
be snow.
Probably about 11,000 is where you'll get snow with this atmospheric river event this weekend.
That's way up there.
It's way up there.
Okay. Brian McInerney, Senior Hydrologist with the National Weather Service, as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the invite.
Thanks. You bet.
All right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to you, Carolyn.
All right.
About what's going on with Recycle Utah and your new facility, new home. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Bill Rock. The Vail Epic Promise Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is a proud supporter of KPCW. It now can provide Park City Mountain employees with emergency relief grants. Information about employee grants is available at epicpromise.com.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away. Carolyn Wara is the executive director of Recycle Utah. She joins me as guest co-host and my next guest because you have some interesting things going on at Recycle Utah in terms of, well, you have to find a new home, where that new home might be, when you're going to move. You also have some information to share about your styrofoam program and some of the challenges there. Actually, I want to start with that one. Let's start with that one, can we?
Yeah, let's talk about styrofoam.
Okay.
Everybody seems to want to talk about styrofoam.
Okay.
Days.
You get a lot of styrofoam.
Yes. We looked at last year. We got about 2,600 cubic feet of styrofoam. To put your head around that idea, that's about 86 trash trucks.
86.
Filled with styrofoam.
Just styrofoam.
This is before we process it. You know, before you process, styrofoam is about 95 to 98% air. So it takes up a lot of space, but it's not real heavy. So when you talk about, you know, we processed 7 tons of styrofoam last year, that's kind of a small number, but you keep in mind you put all the air back into it, and we can fill about 86 to 90 trash trucks full of styrofoam.
Where does all this styrofoam come up? Do you have any sense of where this origin of the styrofoam is? Comes from
residents and businesses.
Yeah, but from our kind of mail order lifestyle.
Yeah, I think the mail order lifestyle has gotten a lot
online
more popular.
Shopping
and technology. A lot of people want the latest technology, and you know, a new flat screen
Everything
TV
comes in styrofoam.
And then a lot of people are doing those meal kits at home, you know, that you'll get the Hello Fresh or the Blue Apron. Yeah. And it'll come in a cardboard box with a styrofoam box inside it. So we see a lot of that. But I think the convenience economy is really taking a big toll on our styrofoam.
Okay, really? So you see tremendous volumes of it. Like you say, it's not very heavy, but it's volumes of it. So what do you do with it typically when it arrives there?
Well, it takes up a lot of space, so our big goal is to get it out as quick as we can. Right now, our back bay is filled to the ceiling, no joke, with styrofoam.
We
just walk around the styrofoam mound all the time because our machine is broken. We have a machine, it's called a densifier. It essentially grinds all the styrofoam into little tiny snowballs, and then those snowballs are compacted, you know, smushed a bunch of times until they come out as a hard, solid brick. And then these bricks are what actually is being used as a recycled commodity. It's one of the few materials it's the only material we actually recycle on site. When it's in this brick commodity, it's a recycled material ready to go sell at the recycling markets.
So it comes out, like you say, densified into a form that is much, much, much less volume.
Right.
By magnitudes and heavier.
Yeah.
It's literally a brick or a log, depending on the length of it. So then you're able to, in effect, send that to someone, sell that to someone who reuses it or turns it back into.
It can turn back into styrofoam, you know, turn into another TV to send out, you know, to go around another TV. Or surfboards, that's kind of a fun thing. Surfboards, they'll put some waxy stuff on the outside and the inner side will be styrofoam. Or it's used in construction sometimes because it's kind of a material that gives a little bit, but not too much. If you need something that, you know, like
uses forms or help in forms. Okay, so, but you made the key point here is that your densifier right now is not working.
Right. I apologize to the community that we can't seem to get it working, but if, you know, I went through, we've probably tried without a doubt a dozen things to get this working. And the trickiest part about it is that there's only two of these machines in the state. So there's not a lot of experts, not a lot of parts. It's just a tricky machine to do.
Sure,
there's not a lot of places densifying styrofoam.
Because it's not just smushing it, it's kind of heats it too. It doesn't melt it, but doesn't it have a little heating element to help the squishing process?
There are machines that do, and originally I thought ours did, but I've gotten so up close and personal with the machine, I can tell you it doesn't.
Okay.
It's just a grind and smush process.
All right, so you're trying to remedy that. In the meantime, you're still getting styrofoam every day.
People right, we see about, if anybody's been inside our plastic tent, there's all those big bags that the plastic goes in. They're called super sacks. We fill about 8 of those a day. Right now we're just storing them, or we're sending them down to another recycler in Salt Lake.
So you're looking at perhaps purchasing a new one.
Right, we're looking at a new one tomorrow. We're going to go tour it and see what we think of it. Meanwhile, we have another idea to fix our machine. We took out the part of the computer of the machine. We're sending it away to the manufacturer to see if they can adjust the computer to make the machine work in a different way.
So
it'll function.
The takeaway here is that you obviously want to do the right thing. You want to accept people's styrofoam, and people want to bring it to, and they want to do the right thing too. They don't want this to end up in the landfill, where it can break down into smaller pieces and blow around and stuff and become a nuisance in the land. Plus, it doesn't biodegrade.
No, styrofoam will never really go away.
It doesn't break down.
It'll be in our landfill. It'll be in our water in those tiny pieces.
It physically
forever.
Breaks down, and becomes a nuisance. So you want to get it out of the solid waste stream, but you're having challenges in densifying. So it costs money to it costs money to break to manage this styrofoam. And so if you're looking at a new machine, that's tens of thousands of dollars.
Right. We estimate a new machine would cost us around $20,000 to $25,000 to replace our current machine. And we're probably looking at $6,000 repairs on our current machine. But we are committed to offering this program because it is important. It is something
right.
we do, and styrofoam is not accepted near a curbside bin. So we're here for the community on that. You know, we just need some support. You know, this is a program we're committed to offering, and it's not free for us to do.
It's not free. So,
so the
point is, if I was bringing styrofoam to you, whether I'm a resident or, more importantly, a commercial business that could be bringing a lot of styrofoam to you, we'll also bring some money.
Yeah,
and
I would
drop it off.
I would really appreciate that right now. You know, I feel bad that this has been tricky for us these past couple of months. And right now, the thing that helped us most is a donation to help us support this program and keep it going.
Okay. All right. So those are your challenges with styrofoam. In addition to all the other material you're trying to manage, cardboard, glass, paper, metal, you got that. But I want to, we don't have a lot more time. I want to turn attention to the facility. Right now, you're going to have to find a new home in a couple of years. You have to move. You have trying to figure out where you're moving. And your future is kind of wrapped into the county's solid waste master plan.
Right. Janet Young was just on Leslie Thatcher's show, and
right.
she explained it really well, where we're at with our landfill. It's kind of a time to make a big decision to get some more life out of our current cell and then make plans to, you know, responsibly handle waste at the county. You know, in the end, all of our waste affects our environment, our air, and our water, and if mm-hmm. we handle our waste properly, we can make some major changes on those things. They've determined in this county's solid waste master plan that about 80% of what currently goes into our landfill is recyclable materials. So we got a lot of room to grow here. There's a lot of the ways we can help. Recycle Utah is a specific player, you know, in our education services. That's something we're really good at, kind of the experts on what goes where, the community. And then also that our current site is, we have a short timeline there. Mm. The city owns our site and, you know, we stay there on some service contract free rent.
Right. But it's a small site,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's a very small
and you,
site.
How many cars do you get a day?
We see about 400 cars a day.
400 cars a day over what, a 10-hour period?
Yeah, we're only open about 9 hours
so
every day.
All right, so that's about 40 cars an hour, every hour of the 10 hours. That's one car every 1.5 minutes. So a
right.
constant stream of vehicles coming in into a tight facility. So you need that's a sign of success.
Right.
So you need a bigger home.
Yeah, we want to make it easier for our guests to come and do their recycling. And then also the trucks that are hauling materials out, we don't have a lot of space for a truck to come and get it in
right.
and out. And then storage, like right now with our styrofoam program, the main driving limitation factors, we don't have anywhere to store the styrofoam until we can get our machine going, and that's why we're having such a big issue. You know, and then materials, you know, that will basically get materials hauled out when we don't have space for them anymore. And
okay.
that doesn't allow us to, you know, stockpile things to work markets or when someone's ready. You know, when something's full, it's got to go. We don't have any more space to keep anything.
All right. In the last few minutes, what would be the ideal Recycle Utah? What might that look like for you, Carolyn? What might that include?
I do think I'm pretty excited about partnering with Summit County. I do think that by working together on the solid waste plan as overall initiative, we can accomplish a lot more. So new site, I think that I would like to be next, you know, on a county facility, but then we are the public facing entity there. You know, we are your resource when you come in, you want to know where something goes. We'll have an educational center to answer, you know, questions about recycling.
Right.
And then, you know, provide some space for some other nonprofits in town that, you know, align with what we do. You know, we're not the experts in this, but go talk to them. They're right down the hall. They could help you also. And then, you know, the public drop-off something is something I don't ever want to lose. You know, you come in with your materials and you put what goes here, what goes there, you know, and people can learn a lot by doing the recycling themselves, and we're here for that. So
right.
public drop-off and the education are two things that
education, maybe some demonstration
yeah.
areas for...
we could do composting demonstrations,
demonstration.
You know, kids' classes. We don't have any space right now to do any...
Native plant.
Yeah. We could do a lot of things if we had some more space, but we don't have any space at the center to host anything other than the parking lot. You know?
So you're going to be at the county's presentation... Of the Solid Waste Master Plan conclusions and recommendations?
Yep. Next Wednesday, April 11th. They haven't quite set an agenda, what time will be on the agenda yet. But a big ask to the community, you know, this is Recycle Utah's time to find a new home. And if that means a lot to you, definitely let County Council know at that meeting on the 11th. Or you can always email them at countycouncil@summitcounty.org. Again, this is our time to find a new home, and the County Council's going to make a decision about that. And if you have a strong opinion, I encourage you to let them know.
Perfect. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, actually, we're going to continue the conversation in the recycling, upcycling area, converting plastic bags into mats and such, ground cover. And we'll get to that right after these words from our sponsors and underwriters. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, Carolyn Wara, my guest co-host today, and joining us in studio is Caitlin McLean.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You're a student at the University of Utah.
I am.
And you started a program there called Bags to Beds. And we'll get into the details first. But first, let's find out a little bit about you, Caitlin. What are you studying at the U?
I'm a dual major in biomedical physics and psychology.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you decided to combine those two majors to make these bags. No, what motivated you to want to do something like this, to take plastic bags, shopping bags, and crochet them into mats, the ground cover, we'll call them ground cover mats or so.
Sure, yeah.
What was the motivation behind that?
So it was a compilation of things. I've always been very involved in community service and in the Benyon Center, which is the community service center at the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a student leader there, and I actually saw a video on Facebook, if you can believe it, about this plastic yarn. They call it Plarn, affectionately.
Plarn.
Turns out that's existed since the 80s. I had never heard of it before. But it's been used for all sorts of things, rugs for your back porch or purses and things like that. And I thought, well, why don't we do something a little bit more useful with it? And then I was a little intrigued. My mom said, maybe now you'll finally get into crocheting. And I said, I don't know, maybe. Very into sustainability, but I don't think I need a rug. And then a couple weeks later, I read an article about the homeless population in Salt Lake and the unfortunate number of people who just don't make it through the night sleeping outside.
Right.
So I decided to combine those two ideas and make mats.
That's fantastic. And when did you start?
We just started this. I pitched it the last day of October. So
you pitched it, meaning you pitch it to the Benyon Center?
I did, yeah. Unintentionally, actually. I was at a service project. Somebody said, what's new? And instead of saying nothing, I said, actually, I have this idea. Let's do it. And they said, great, yeah, let's do it.
Meaning you do it.
Yeah, meaning me do it. Yeah, and it's been amazing. They've really helped facilitate finding people who are interested in these kinds of things and get it going.
All right, let's talk about the process. First of all, this is taking normal thin film, plastic shopping bags that now we have a bag ban up here in Park City, so you can't get them at the couple of supermarkets. But if you go to Kimball Junction, you'll get lots of plastic bags out there. Everybody knows what we're talking about, this thin film shopping bags. You take these bags, and I saw the video. I was intrigued by one of the, there's a number of videos online you can watch about how this crocheting process, and it's fascinating and I'll say, not easy. I bet it gets your full attention. You have to be very mind. It's a very mindful activity, crocheting, isn't it? You just get into it and have to pay attention.
It's interesting, actually. I thought that when I was first learning, but it becomes very mindless, actually. It becomes very passive. So a lot of our volunteers, a lot of them are students, as you can imagine.
Yes.
And the best selling point is that this is a project you can do in your downtime. So when a person, you need a brain break, you can't study all day, right?
Right.
When they decide to watch TV, listen to the radio, they can actually crochet or make the yarn while they're doing that, which is really nice.
Yeah. I crochet. I do it while I watch TV, normally.
All right.
It's very relaxing to me.
It is.
So how is this different from normal crocheting?
It's not.
It's not.
The only difference is that the yarn you're using happens to be made out of plastic. So that texture gets a little, you know, you need to get used to that a little bit. But it's just a single stitch crochet, 3 feet by 6 feet. That's it.
Okay. And I know this is radio. It's difficult, obviously. You have a mat here with you.
Yes.
And the process is very visual, too. But you literally take the bags, you kind of flatten them out, make sure they're even space. You do a little cutting and trimming. You create these circular bands or so, threads, and then you kind of loop them together.
Exactly.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
I was paying attention through that part. But then when the single stitch thing came, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So 3 feet by 6 feet, how many bags do you think are in this
It's 300 to 400 bags per mat.
Wow.
Three to 400 bags per mat.
And you would think that's a lot, but anytime you said you have some bags under your kitchen sink, some people have over 100. So, and recently we've started working with actually the Utah Food Bank. As you can imagine, most of their donations come in plastic bags. So now they bring those plastic bags to us.
Wow. And so how many do you have in on stock?
On stock right now? Ooh, I shudder to think. Probably about
thousands?
3,000 probably.
Okay. How long does it take you to... Obviously, that's going to vary depending on skill levels, but what's the average time to take to produce a mat?
We estimate it's about 30 hours to crochet a mat. The good news is that most of that's fairly passive, so I can get one done in about 2 weeks.
So to give our listeners an idea what this looks like, it's kind of like your Therm-a-Rest that you'd bring camping, like a camping mat. It looks kind of like that, but it's made of plastic bags. It's rolled up here in like a little log.
Yeah.
And pick it up. How much does it weigh, Carolyn?
Oh, it's super light. I'd take this backpacking.
Give it to me.
Yeah.
They're
very lightweight, yeah.
Oh, just a pound or two.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple pounds.
Very lightweight. And then those very thick bags that we get sometimes from shopping stores that aren't grocery bags, we actually weave those into handles so people can carry these around during the winter.
Wow. So this is a pretty tight weave in terms of... Okay, it needs to be a tight weave. Here's the one thing I'm curious about. It's how it wears, how it puts up to wear and tear. I mean, these are thin film plastic bags to begin with. So they don't, you know, they have a lot of tensile strength, but they don't have a lot of durability, you know, in an abrasive environment like being thrown down on the ground or so. So, I mean, it does have a half-life, let's be honest.
Sure.
I mean, if they wear out over time. But have you done some tests on that?
A little bit, yeah. So... Some of it's through experience, right? Like the first mat we made, we carry around all over the place. We demonstrate with it a lot, and it gets a little bit worn. This weaving that you do when you crochet, it kind of doubles and triples up on the thickness of that bag.
Yeah.
And so even if it gets worn in one place, it's very secure. And then the other thing we've noticed, too, is that if it does wear out in a specific spot, you can always just go back and crochet that in with new bags.
Oh, you can?
You can, yeah, because it's all crocheted, and because plastic bags, you can just cut them and retie them. If it does start to unravel, we can just tie that back together and then crochet in the patch. So I like to think that they have a longer half-life than you might think.
Okay, that's great to know.
Yeah.
A couple more minutes. Any questions? So, here's how I found out about you guys. I know I want to shout out to the magazine Catalyst.
Yes.
You guys were profiled. And I have to tell you, this photograph, that's you.
That is
and
me.
And a friend.
Yes.
That is the greatest photograph.
Thank you.
I was inspired to get in touch with you. Just seeing that photo of how you were happy, you were comfortable. It's like, come, learn how to crochet plastic bags. Can you teach us how to do that up here?
Oh, absolutely. We were just teaching some people out there while we were waiting.
That's what I thought. Maybe we Recycle Utah may want to host an event.
Yeah, plastic bag crocheting class.
Yeah, but then you would see lots of plastic bags.
Right, we try to encourage people to not use plastic bags.
Oh, exactly. We fully agree with you there.
I'd rather not have any plastic bags at the recycle center.
That's a good point. But this is a wonderful way of upcycling these bags. You know, otherwise that would. Well, might be used as garbage bags for some people, but they still end up in the trash.
Right, and especially in Salt Lake, people talk about a lot, and they're not accepted in the bins now.
right.
these plastic bags. The unfortunate truth is they weren't getting recycled long before that because of the machines they use. They just gum up the machines. We just don't have the technology here.
Yep, we know
the
that.
Resources dedicated yeah. to it. So what we do is when you make these, you actually cut off pieces of the bag, and then we send those out to a place that specializes in melting down these bags. Because otherwise they get caught up in machines and they just end up in the trash.
They're gumming up the material recovery facilities.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right.
We learned
mm-hmm.
that.
That's a big problem.
That's
yeah.
a big problem. All right. How do people get in touch with you to learn more about this process
yeah.
or go online and see the process?
Absolutely. So we've got a website. It's just bagstobeds.org. A Facebook page. Again, that's bagstobeds, just T-O. And people can message us on that Facebook at any time. That's actually me directly. And then we have an email address that's bagstobeds@gmail.com. They can reach out any way they'd like. We love to host events. We love to teach people. We would love to teach you, and then you can teach your friends. Anything
yeah.
we can to get these mats done. We're trying to get over 100 done by November.
Okay. Where yeah. are you right now?
We have about 7 done and about 25 underway. So we're on
wow.
the way. Yeah.
Okay. But a lot to do.
Yes.
And hopefully our listeners may want to include themselves in this event. Okay, go ahead.
Have you started giving any out yet, or is that going to be a big event, like a mat distribution event? Or
Both.
Okay.
So we're working right now with a couple of resource centers that work with homeless youth, and they're distributing now. And then we're actually planning on mass distributing at what's called Project Homeless Connect, mm-hmm. which happens in October. That's our main deadline for that 100 mats, because we'd like to have them all ready for the people that come in that day.
Are you getting credit for this? You better be getting
credit?
Some school credit.
No.
What?
No, just
what's
the good feeling
school?
It gives you, you know.
I know. You're very good. Caitlin McLean?
Yes.
At the University of Utah. Again, the website is bagstobeds.org.
Yes.
Or the Facebook page. Learn more about crocheting shopping bags, thin film shopping bags, into mats or other things.
Sure.
Right? You can crochet. The sky's the limit
right.
for crocheting.
And if you want to get involved in this, will you like give someone all the bags they need to get started?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. We have plenty. Yes.
Maybe a poncho. Okay. Maybe some type of clothing. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know what? We gotta wrap up.
Oh, yeah. It's that time.
Yeah. Well, thanks again to Brian McInerney for coming on the show. From the National Weather Service, updating us on all things weather and climate. And Kate McLean, again, with Bags to Beds. Great idea. Go to the website. If you've got a Catalyst magazine, they're all over the place, all over town. It's in the back, near the back, profiled Bags to Beds, a little article about them, a photo of Caitlin. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who help make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah.
Woo! Republic Services.
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Vail Epic Promise.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
San Francisco Design.
Park City Mountain.
And listeners like you.
Most importantly, listeners like you.
It's my favorite show.
Right. You guys
other than Leslie.
Yeah, okay.
I gotta stay in tune what's happening. But
right.
This Green Earth is my personal favorite show.
Thank you. And we appreciate you coming on to co-host today. Remember, yes, if you guys have any thoughts or ideas for shows or topics you'd like us to cover, email us your thoughts and comments to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. Again, Carolyn, thanks for coming
thanks
on.
Thanks for having me.
We'll look forward to seeing you at least at the April 11th
yep.
Summit County
next week.
Council meeting on the Solid Waste Master Plan. And that's our rollout music. Again, thanks. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back. NPR News is coming up.